This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3759 for Thursday, the 29th of December, 2022. Today's show is entitled, Chatting with Dint. It is hosted by some guy on the internet and is about 44 minutes long. It carries a clean flag. The summary is, small talk on spend free software.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Hacker Public Radio. I'm some guy on the internet and I'm here speaking with
DNT.
And today we're just going to be chatting about a little bit of technology. Let's start off with the Raspberry Pi. DNT, have you heard anything lately on a Raspberry Pi?
I have heard lately that it's hard to find a Raspberry Pi, but I think that's kind of always been the case, at least occasionally. Lately, I've heard a lot about this big thing at on Mastodon with moderation. Some big controversy that happened there.
Oh yeah, the controversy there at Mastodon, that's a big one. Let's segue into that one. Let's start off with that part about it being hard to find. It's been hard to find for quite some time now, except for the scammers or the scalpers. Online, they've seemed to have a pretty healthy supply of them. It's just consumers, the rest of us, the enthusiasts, we seem to have trouble getting them.
What's up with scalpers? How did they get the Raspberry Pis then?
My guess is, from what they were saying, is they're doing a lot of B2B type work right now, business to business versus business to consumer sales. So some of the small businesses they're supplying, and this is just a guess, it's not like I got any paperwork to back this up. Some of those small businesses are doing a couple of bulk loads to people they know, and those people are running around online just selling them for outrageous prices. The last price I saw for a Raspberry Pi 4 compute module was $207 just for the compute module, and that was on Amazon.
Yeah, that makes sense. There must be this inventory that they're getting their hands on, I guess. So I've only ever had one. I have a Model 3B or something like that. The one that doesn't have any USB 3 ports, doesn't have gigabit Ethernet, I think.
I've got two of the 3B. They're the standard 3B that's in the same form factor as the 4B. Except I don't have the 3B Plus, so they don't have Bluetooth and Wi-Fi on them. But they're still good for things like if you want to do DNS or any Samba, anything like that where it's going to be connected Ethernet-wise. Or just learning, because when I first bought them, I was just using them to learn how to do anything with Linux. I didn't have a spare computer to test stuff like SSH on. I could plug that in and learn how to SSH into it. I think I have like four Raspberry Pi 4s, except one of them's dead now. I'm pretty sure it's dead because it will not power on anymore. I was running it as a Nextcloud server for quite some time, and I noticed it was powered off. Couldn't get it to come back on.
Yeah, so are you looking for more Raspberry Pis? Looks like you're well stocked with them already from what you just said.
Well, I use them for small projects, and like, say, for instance, the one that I was using on my network here, that was doing my Nextcloud out. So whenever I had to send files to someone, rather than uploading the file to the email server and then, you know, trusting that file in the hands of, say, Google with Gmail, I would upload it to my Nextcloud, send a link through email, and that way the link can actually expire. Even if a bad actor got it, the link can also be password protected. So, you know, it gave me a little bit of security, and the file was still on the device I own. I got a little bit more control over that. One of the things that helped me in having multiple Raspberry Pi 4s is when I wanted to test out new things that I wanted to deploy on my network, I have an exact replica of the machine I'm running in production. You know what I mean? So I can do all the testing on another Raspberry Pi here just to see if I can get it all working. Like when I wanted to get what's called Bookstacks up and running alongside Nextcloud. That failed miserably. I don't know what I did wrong, but it didn't work out. And I'm glad I didn't try that on production. I have a wonderful little test environment that's exactly the same as production. And the other ones, they're doing things like, they're the smaller ones, like the 2 gig. That one's running a digital photo frame. And the other one, that one's running the LAN-based Nextcloud.
That's cool. That's fancy. So you've got your production environment and your test environment. Yeah, After a while, I stopped running any kind of heavier applications, like anything with server-side stuff. Yeah, now I mostly just have some Git repositories and Task Warrior server and a couple other very simple things like that. So one thing that I use quite a lot for my stuff is Git Annex. It's something I definitely owe a show about. There's been one show by Klaatu about Git Annex, but it was kind of a little bit superficial. I could talk for a while about Git Annex, I guess.
Well, since you brought it up, I mean, just give me like a 50,000 foot view of Git Annex. You're talking to a complete noob that's only heard the term here with you. So, I mean, just tell me a little bit about it while we're here.
Cool. So Git Annex is one of the various solutions that exist for storing larger binary files in a Git repository. Basically, any file that is not really interesting or useful to have that change tracking that Git does. So Git Annex is kind of a really sophisticated one, that because a lot of times the trade-off for storing the larger file in Git is that it's not actually version controlled usually, or at least like it is version controlled somewhat, but the history is not actually kept, so you can't actually go back to an older commit and get that larger file. I believe Git LFS, which is Git Large File Storage, I think that's the one that's supported by GitHub. It won't keep the older files, right? Git Annex does. And there's a lot of cool stuff about it. The documentation is a little bit hard to get into. It definitely takes a while for you to understand some things about Git Annex. It's kind of a weird thing. But the main thing that I like about it, the reason I use it, is because you can basically have the whole file structure, the folder structure, on your computer, but not have the actual files on your computer, right? For example, I have one Git repository where I have almost every project I've ever worked on when I was a freelancer doing video, or nowadays more kind of personal projects. I have it all there and I can kind of browse it, but I don't have the actual data, right? Then there's a Git command, Git Annex get, that will actually go SSH into my Raspberry Pi and then download the file. And you know, the file that's in your directory is a link to is a symlink to a file that's in the .git directory. And then that's where the actual data is, right? And there's a bunch of other stuff about it, but that's kind of the essential thing, the reason I use it. I kind of like that idea of having the folder structure and being able to browse it to some extent, and then just download the file when I need to look at it. So like, for example, if I remember vaguely that I had a file and I remember what it was named, I can do a find and find that file. And it can be a file that I saved to the repository like 10 years ago, and then I can just do Git Annex get and get it.
Okay, so now one of the things I'm wondering about is with Git, I still haven't taken the time to learn how to use Git, but I know the purposes of Git, the version control for mostly source code, but I guess you can also use it for documentation and other writing. I don't understand why a binary would be up there unless you wanted to release the binary to users. I don't understand why you, like the developer, would have the binary up there when I would assume you'd be building from source a lot of the time, unless you wanted to avoid building from source.
Yeah, you're definitely right about that. There's generally no good reason to store a binary in the Git repository. Like sometimes a project will do it just for convenience because they would, you know, let's say you have a Git repository that you need multiple people to download and run something. And then maybe there's a dependency that it's just very convenient to just have the built binary in the repository itself, so it's downloaded when you clone it. But it's a little, you know, it's a little clunky. There's no really good reason to do it.
Okay. All right. So I guess that helps clear it up a little bit. And you're still using it today for personal projects.
Yeah. So, you know, whenever I there are some projects that I would prefer to track them in their own Git repository. But a lot of smaller stuff, I'll just, at the end of it, I'll just move the directory into my big Git NX repository. Then I'll check everything into that, and I'll just do a commit, and then I'll drop the file. So then that way I'll have the file structure as symlinks, but the actual files that take up storage space won't be on my computer anymore. They'll just be in the Raspberry Pi from then on. And the files, as they're stored on the Raspberry Pi, they're GPG encrypted. In the Raspberry Pi, they're just a huge directory, and the files are GPG encrypted, and their name are like a, it's like, you know, content addressed or whatever you would call it, so that the file name is in some way obscured as well.
Now, when you use GPG to encrypt, do you encrypt the directory or the files themselves?
Each file is encrypted. This is done by the script, by the Git NX application, I guess. It's a Haskell application, so that can be kind of inconvenient sometimes because it takes about a billion dependencies. I don't know if that's very common for all of Haskell, but it seems like they always come with a lot of dependencies.
Speaking of Haskell, we're going to have to get the what's a user, one of the correspondents here at HBR, is it Tutorto, I believe the name her name is?
Tutorto, yeah. They might have some thoughts on what I just said about Haskell.
Yeah, gonna have to drag them in here, have a showdown. All right, so you're using your Raspberry Pis for development, and sounds like a little bit of content distribution right there. And I'll be honest with you, that sounds like a fair way to get malware.
Go have it.
How so?
Well, I mean, if you're grabbing binaries off of Git repositories, I mean, at least with the source code out, you know, you can kind of comb through it, see where there's an issue. But if you're just grabbing binaries and you're not exactly, like, say, for instance, if there's like four or five people, I guess, managing one Git repository, what was it called? It's not ransomware. They called it protestware. I think that's what it was called. The whole protestware thing came about, where that one guy created a program that looked for your location, and if you were in Russia, it would delete all your files.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, but I mean, all these repositories were created by me, right? I don't share them with anyone. I just have them. I guess I use it mostly as a backup. You know, whenever I need since I have so much of whatever I'm doing, yeah, usually in a Git repository in some way. Then, for example, whenever I need to just trash my system and reinstall it, the only thing I really need is the SSH key and the GPG key, and I can just get everything back again.
Ah, sweet. Okay, so I understand a little bit clearer now. This is just all personal. So you're just managing external storage like this.
Yeah, all just Git repositories that I created and uploaded myself.
So are you booting through USB? I'm hoping you're booting through USB, because that sounds like it'd be a nightmare if you're booting from the SD card.
So the way I have it is the system is on an SD card, but most of the data is in external hard drive. But the thing is, it's all USB 2, so it is actually quite slow, and that's one of the reasons I wish I could get a Raspberry Pi 4 so that I could have faster drives, and then all those file transfers over the network are much faster.
Yeah, for personal use, you can stomach it for a while, but I imagine after some time, it'll definitely start to cause a bit of frustration. I used to boot off of, on one of my Raspberry Pi 4s, I was booting off of an old laptop hard drive, because I mean, it was just lying around doing nothing. And those laptop hard drives, those like 5,400 RPMs. So yeah, sure, I got like a free terabyte lying around, but boy, was it slow. I had our family Nextcloud running off of that for a little while. And I got some looks about that. So I went ahead and switched it on over to a 1 terabyte Western Digital Blue Drive.
Yay!
And that increased the performance substantially.
So what's the disadvantage of just having the system run on the SD card?
SD card's going to have much lower read-write endurance, so you're gonna burn through SD cards a lot faster depending on your usage. With the SD card, we will go through it much faster than you would, since you're just the only one writing to it. And from what it sounds like, you're normally just storing onto it. You're not actually running off of it. With us, we're running, you know, Nextcloud, which has the database and applications and everything like that constantly reading and writing.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's what I used to have. One of the first things I did when I got this Raspberry Pi was Nextcloud. And then, yeah, just the whole thing just seemed kind of slow to me. So I intentionally changed to ways of doing all that. It's been a lot smoother, and I almost never have to think about it anymore. The only other thing I think I have, I installed one of those like a calendar and contacts, like a standalone. It's called Radical, I guess, is how you would pronounce it. It's like radical with an E at the end. So it's just having web, CalDAV and CardDAV, but not as part of your regular web server. So I didn't have to have a full web server. It runs just fine.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So that still gives you the functionality to sync everything up using just the front end on your desktop, and the back end would just be the Pi for the storage.
Yeah, but I feel like that's kind of the least secure part there, because that's the only, one of the only times where there's data, sensitive data stored in plain text on the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah, I was worried about that, but by having them separated, one on the LAN and having my LAN separated into multiple different subnets and everything, I worried less about it. Now, that one that was connected to the internet before it died, yeah, that one's a different story. I mean, lots of monitoring went on there, and I really didn't want to keep any files on it, just mainly whatever I needed to send out. I wanted to always have a Nextcloud instance ready for that. And I mean, it worked, and I got attacked a lot, but I didn't see anything where somebody actually got through, gained root access or anything like that. I was able to tighten it up pretty good to where I banned anybody that tried to connect.
Yeah, I need to do a little bit of that, just trying to check. I've never seen any kind of activity like that on my Raspberry Pi. So, but maybe it's because I've never looked.
Yeah, did you open it up to the internet? Like, you got any ports forward and out or anything?
Yeah, but very well. What do I have? Yeah, I mean,
you just got the 22.
Yeah, I still have. Well, no, I changed it to a something other than 22, right? Yeah, that's the. I mean, I did. I think that was on the. There's a Arch Linux. The Arch Wiki has a. I know your opinions about Arch Linux, by the way, but Arch Linux, their wiki, they had like a list of security recommendations, and one of them was that. I think that's probably where I got that from. But yeah, changing the default SSH port to something else. And then I have a couple of others, but none of the common ones, like because I don't actually have a web server running on that either. So,
yeah, one of the reasons I didn't, and this could be a misunderstanding of mine, is from what I was reading, port between 0 and 1000 require root. Those are like system ports. So if you go to a port beyond that, it would not require root to access those ports. And that's why I wanted to keep it at 22. I could have changed it beyond 22 and then just managed it through the SSH config and through documentation as well. But the SSH config would just hold that information, so I don't have to remember what the port is.
Yeah, and then you have those. You have those other, like, fail to ban and all that. So, yeah. I don't know. I think, I'd be interested in looking at this kind of information about my Raspberry Pi here, whether anyone has tried to log in or anything, but I've never, at least just occasionally looking at logs, I've never seen any kind of activity like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not until they find out about it that you start seeing a lot of crap going on. And even then, I mean, it's usually the same type of attacks, them trying to break in through SSH or whatever services you have running. You'll start to notice.
How would they find out about it?
My guess is they're just scanning.
Yeah, so I guess let's say if you know how they get it, how they find out about how an attacker might find out about your home server and might start trying to target you, then record a show about it and let us all know.
Pretty sure it's going to be just a whole lot of scanning. Like you probably have like IP ranges and you just ping everything within the range, and whatever sends back a message is like, okay, that's a device. I'm assuming that's how it goes.
Yeah, I guess they can go in and scan for open ports and go from there. I don't know. But yeah, I used to have a subdomain of my actual personal website pointing to my home IP address and then forwarded to that Raspberry Pi. But I've changed that to a completely nondescript domain that I got, and that just links to that IP. So, and you know, there are things like that. Maybe you've heard of PageKite as well. That's another thing I've thought about trying out, but haven't yet. It's supposed to be like a more secure way to expose your some parts of your home network to the internet.
No, I'd never heard of PageKite. One of the things that got to me from everything that I dug up is a lot of the tools that I found, like especially Fail2Ban, were built on top of the default Linux kernel firewall software, so like IP tables. And I figured if I just learned IP tables or enough about IP tables, I could just implement all the features I want with basically just banning everybody that tried to log in except for myself.
Yeah, I think I've noticed that too. It seems like a lot of the firewall applications are kind of like wrappers around IP tables because their commands are like a little more esoteric or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, and the only reason I wanted to do it, because I was bored at the time as well too. You know, you're bored and you got a couple of books lying around. It's like, let me go ahead and get into something.
Which firewall application do you use now?
IP tables, but the desktop that I'm on, I think this is running NF tables, which is I think some of the command structures are similar, but I don't know enough about NF tables to even attempt it. But on all my servers, I'm running older versions, 2004 of Ubuntu, so that way I can maintain IP tables on those. But I'm eventually going to update my knowledge to cover NF tables.
So speaking of Ubuntu 2004, I just went back home to Brazil for a couple of weeks and I found a little CD case, one of those that have multiple pockets you can slip CDs into. And I found in there some Ubuntu 12.04 and I think 10.10 that were the first Ubuntu CDs that somebody gave me, the first Linux operating systems I installed ever.
You going to get brave and try to run them today?
No, I left it there. It's just a relic of the past now. I think I saw someone maybe on Mastodon talking about like still having their first CD. I remember at the time it was when I was living in the UK, this French guy came in to work on something at the hostel I worked at, and then he was like a Linux geek, and then he started telling me all about it, and then he gave me a CD. And I wasn't even going to install it anywhere, but he said, no, just keep it. Maybe later you'll want to try it.
That's something I never took part in. I'd never got into the CD because I came into it later. 2019 is when I got into Linux, so it's been all Windows before then. So I never experienced the CD world of Linux.
Yeah, I had kind of two phases. There was that, and then I used Ubuntu for a while. But then later, when I started working as a video editor, in the video industry, you're supposed to use a Mac. At least you were a while. And so then I bought a MacBook Pro, and then I used it for several years.
You've been happy with Linux so far? Like, is there anything about it that kind of makes you want to go back to the Mac, or you're pretty good right now with Linux only?
No, it's good. It's definitely a lot more. I think it's more user friendly today than it was back then. And also, I'm more savvy today than I was. Like, you know, I can. Back then, I hardly ever even wanted to be on the terminal, right? And that's not the case anymore. And also, a lot of the media applications are much better than they were back then. You know, now there's Krita, and KDE and Live is better than it used to be. And it was usable back then, even. But also, I think the Mac operating system is also in some ways worse than it used to be, I think.
Yeah, I think with Mac, I think they just got a little lazy. Kind of lock everything down and trickle out features every now and again, like meaningless features. What they do have that's great is that ecosystem. Once you're in the ecosystem, it's great. You can just survive there with just everything that they have today with no new features for years, and it'll still feel incredible. However, if you're truly trying to get ahead and you want to just draw out every ounce of power your system has, I cannot find anything better than Linux.
Yeah, the best thing about using a Mac, for example, the reason I wish I could use one at work for my work computer is that you can run, Linux or Unix-y applications on a Mac. So not the case on Windows, you know.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I use Windows for gaming, but trying to do any kind of work on Windows, just so much frustration.
Yeah, it's been dreadful. But also I think I would say nowadays I understand and appreciate the free software part of it a lot more. Like, I'm much more willing to use an application that's maybe in some ways less convenient, but more freedom producing.
Same here. One of the main things is I want to avoid the rug pull.
Yeah, and the funny thing is then observing as you start to have this kind of a perspective, we can clearly see when other people just kind of then step onto this new other rug that looks nice and they're like, oh, this rug is a lot better than the rug I was just on before. But then you're like, well, yeah, you're still just, just waiting for someone to pull that rug from under your feet.
Yeah, and each new rug they step on gets smaller and smaller. So, I mean, eventually, I don't know what they're going to be just standing barefooted on the ground after a while. I mean, think about it. You can't even own your software these days. It's all done through the software as a service crap. So, like, for those people that use, like, Microsoft Word, the Microsoft Office suite, miss one payment and you get locked out of all your work. How are you going to get your work done? You got to, use the web UI or something like that. Whereas if you just go ahead and donate $100 over to LibreOffice, I mean, if you can't pay it next year, that's cool. You keep going and then you pay when you can.
Yeah. So I'm going to say first, in a minute, we need to get back to the promise we made at the beginning of the show that we were going to talk about the Raspberry Pi controversy as well. Yeah. But I want to say real quick, there's this development that's happened recently that it was this application called Figma that's used for UX design usually, and it was purchased by Adobe. And Figma is known for being kind of one of the most advanced design applications that can run on the browser, and it can run very well, right? There have been technical articles about it, about how they achieved this and all that. So I feel like Adobe buying Figma is a huge step in this continuing shift that we've been seeing about running applications in the cloud. You know, I think Figma really is like a kind of a step up where it's a really sophisticated application and really complete that's running in the browser. So, I don't know. I think we're going to see more and more examples of this, unfortunately.
I agree. Back to the Pi. Now, there were claims made by the Raspberry Pi Foundation a while back that the Raspberry Pi 4 was a desktop replacement. I don't know if you heard any of those.
Yeah, I remember that.
Have you ever had a chance to try the Raspberry Pi 4, like just actually get some work done on it?
No, I've never had one.
I have attempted this desktop replacement idea that they had. And let me tell you, under the guise of an educational device, I would offer them leniency on that statement. But if you're just talking about somebody creating a computer and it is just a consumer device, you use it and they call it a desktop replacement in a small form factor, and it's the Raspberry Pi, I would call it a crap device. It is in no way a desktop replacement. This is one of the things that bring my frustration with the Raspberry Pi Foundation. Them lowering the availability of the device to the community, yet serving so many businesses, took them out of the educational realm and put them square in just industrial and other business. They're just out for profit now. And they no longer get that leniency of, okay, it's an educational device that we tinkerers love to play with.
So then that makes a decent segue for the Mastodon controversy with the Raspberry Pi. I think I wrote in the HPR's Matrix channel that it's like an interesting situation, because then a lot of people, it's like they, you got the Raspberry Pi that you like for reasons A, And then now there's this other reason that you have for not liking them, you know, and then people are kind of struggling with that, and they kind of want, you know, it's like you're challenging your values a little bit, and then you have to decide what is more important to you. But to be honest, I don't really remember exactly what the controversy is, which is really telling, I think. So are you able to kind of recap a little bit?
Yeah, from what I was able to dig up, the controversy, it started with a new hire, a detective that was doing surveillance with some police department or whatever. He was using Raspberry Pis and other devices, right, trying to surveil criminals. I guess he left that area of work and went to the Raspberry Pi Foundation. Maybe he got burnt out or whatever. Who knows? But he went to the Raspberry Pi Foundation, and some users were a little bit upset about that. But they weren't upset directly with the Raspberry Pi Foundation. They were upset about the hire of that guy. Now, how the Raspberry Pi Foundation responded is where the issue came in. They were a little tone deaf, and they began, you know, banning people and, I guess, reacting in a way that was not what we'd expect from an organization. So it just poured gasoline on a very small fire. They could have just ignored it and it would have went away. I mean, who cares? They just hired some guy out there, you know?
Yeah, you're exactly right, I think. And they hired this guy, and then they posted on Mastodon kind of a little bit bragging about his background for whatever reason. And then some people complained, and then, yeah, it could have just been left at that, and probably there would have been no big deal. But, yeah, I share your view that the bigger problem was their response to it, and then it just showed. But what was there was also like a, you know, they seemed to make a commitment to not moderating things, and then that would be a reason for people to defederate their instance. Is that right?
Yeah, I heard a little bit about that. That part I did not dig into, but I did see a couple of threats to space themselves from the Raspberry Pi. My biggest issue wasn't the hire itself, but what the hire brings with it. Because this guy is, from my understanding, is not a developer. He didn't deploy the Pi in some new way that's going to allow them to bring wider adoption. Instead, I believe he just has a lot of contacts. He's like a networking hire. You hire him because he's going to put you in contact with a bunch of other sales. That's what I feel like his hire really was. Because other than that, what else is he bringing to the table? They talk about his years of experience. That does nothing. I mean, the enthusiast that built the Raspberry Pi brand to up to where it is today have done 10 times more what this guy's ever done. You know, all he's done is drill a little hole in the lamp, stuck a camera in it, and connected it to a Pi. Probably followed a forum he saw online. That's nothing new.
So where did you get that view from about it being a networking hire?
I just put it all together in my head. I didn't find any information to support my beliefs on that. I just thought of it and said it here today.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't think of that. I guess I didn't really read much about it, but I don't know. I thought I think people should be able to, you know, whatever you think about the police, people should be able to hire former police officers. I don't think people who go into that career should necessarily then have no other career options. I think, you know, whatever anyone thinks about the police, people are, you know, generally we should believe that people can change. So that shouldn't be a big deal.
I do not like those broad brush where you just look at a group of people or an industry or anything and automatically classify the entire thing as bad. Therefore, all of the good that has been done is now, you know, tainted. That leads to things like racism and other just parts of our culture that I want to avoid. So whenever I see people take that radical perspective, you just go, all cops are bad. No, I just can't support that.
Yeah, it seemed to me like that kind of thing was maybe what drove the initial criticism of the post.
Yeah, I believe so. I think for them to redeem themselves, first of all, they're going to have to do something about this whole promise they've made to support businesses and just leave their. I think they supported the businesses 90% of the products that they have and only allowed like 10% to go out to consumers, causing this, you know, just lopsided shift. The scalpers have product, but the enthusiasts, the people who are actually learning in the environment, we don't have the products that we want, and we have no choice but to even consider buying a $35 Raspberry Pi 4 for $200. You know what I mean? It's nightmarish and crazy to know that they would make such a decision and stand by it for so long.
Yeah, that's a bigger controversy, really. I didn't know that there had been this intentional shift like that. So the trouble too is that then it exposes us to like counterfeits and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a ton of it out there now. But one of the good things I've seen from it, I've been looking at some of the other single board computers that's been coming out. I believe, what's the other one? I think it's called like the Rock Chip or something like that, that they've been dropping some new SBCs. I watch a YouTube channel called Prime something. But he does a lot of, you know, small form factor gaming PCs and things, and he show off a lot of like game emulators and things of that nature, the old NES, Super NES, and etc. And he does a lot of it on the small single board computers. He's been showing off some really good ones. And I've also heard about the Pine Tab coming out. I'm very interested in it's the Pine Tab 2. I'm very interested in that because the first one was only available for what felt like 5 minutes and then you couldn't get them anymore.
Is that a tablet?
Yeah. Because Pine has been doing lots of work to build their store with, you know, they got the Pine Watch and the Pine Buds, the Pine Note. And of course, there was the Pine Book and the Pine Book Pro with the Pine Phone. So there's a lot of development around it. So I'm hoping the documentation and everything's also caught up. I think the Pine Tab is going to be a wonderful device. I'd love to be able to carry a tablet around and, you know, just a small, lightweight Linux device. I'm not too crazy about it being ARM because the inconsistency with the different ARM, you know, architectures, it causes a small problem. I heard about them creating like generic ARM ISOs or images or whatever that can run on any ARM CPU, but I don't know how it's going to work on these smaller devices.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that either.
How about RISC-V? You did any studying or looking up on RISC-V?
Nope. Don't know anything about that either. I do know that it's pronounced RISC-V and not RISC-V, so I'm there.
Yeah, I follow it a little bit, but because I'm not deep into that side of the community, all I can do is kind of look on it with question marks above my head. But that's all I've got. I know it's out there and there's a lot of enthusiasm about it. I do hear a lot of speculation about it, though. They talk about it being the divider between, AMD and Intel. So you're going to get a new freedom-respecting platform to choose in the future, or that's the hope anyway.
Okay, so can you give us, like, how did you say, the 500-foot or meter view of what RISC-V is?
Sure, I can give you one. It'll be very poor, but I can definitely give it to you.
That's the one I want.
Yeah, so basically it's you got the two x86 systems that everybody knows. That's the Intel and the AMD. Well, RISC-V is just a new player in the game, from my understanding, and there are no restrictions on it at the moment, somewhat like ARM, but more freedom respecting. Right now, if you wanted to go PowerPC, you could, but I mean, it's going to put you back in the same boat. You're locked into somebody else's platform. But then there's also RISC-V, which is very open. It's like the, I would compare it to in the encoder world, how you have the NVIDIA encoders. What's the new one? AV1 that's coming out now, how AV1 is like the freedom respecting one that everybody wants now. So that way you don't have to rely on NVIDIA anymore. I would kind of refer to it like that. That's what RISC-V is like, AV1.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's a similar thing to the, you were talking about the codecs there, the image codecs, right? That some of them are not free, which would be the reason Google created VP8 and then VP9 in response to AVC, also known as H.264, and then H.265. But I think I read a while back that the reason Apple created its own architecture was because of the licensing thing because they didn't want to use ARM processor. So, okay, from what you said, RISC-V is like an open kind of a definition of an architecture, of a processor architecture. And then so that then companies are able to build processors that are compatible with each other, right? So, but is there a company that has committed to using it, or is this one of those standards that are going to remain just a standard?
I think it's going to be just a standard for a while because there's a lot more development that has to be done with it. But it's moving, from what I hear, it's moving very quickly, and especially seeing more companies. Once you see more hardware appear, I think that's a very big sign. So when we saw Pine come out with that smaller ARM device, I mean, that's telling me that this thing is much closer than we think. Now, I'm assuming that only major companies are going to have any actual usable devices for a while. Like, you'll probably hear about some RISC-V servers or something being deployed, testing out, but you won't find anything like on a desktop computer anytime soon.
Okay, that's cool. So, yeah, I would invite listeners who know more about RISC-V, about, for example, why a company would want to build a processor following that standard, or what else we might be getting wrong about RISC-V. We could use a show about that because there's a lot of interest in this topic, I think, right?
Definitely. Definitely. Especially after hearing, you know what should definitely make you want to do a show? After hearing me butcher that explanation, you should definitely want to do a show.
Yeah, I think this is something that you and I could specialize in. We just get together and we just misconceive everything we can for about 30 minutes and let people post their response shows. I'll try to think of some topics that I know nothing about, and then we'll get on Mumble.
That sounds about right. Just grab a handful of topics and be like, okay, I heard about it, and then I'll speculate on what I think it is.
I love that.
Yeah, matter of fact, here's a good one as well. You want to know how to convert your code from x86 to ARM?
Okay, how do I do it?
At the top of your code, you just write ARM equals true.
Yeah, that makes sense. That should work, right? Then the computer will see it, read it, and be like, yeah, okay, ARM is true.
Yeah, the very first line, just like in a bash script, how you tell the bash the computer how to interpret the script. Yeah, you just write ARM equals true right there, and you're good to go.
All right. Yeah, see, that's why we need open standards, so you can just say ARM equals true and everything is going to be all right.
Yeah, it worked perfectly fine. You can try it today on any code you have. Just go on GitHub, grab some Haskell or some Rust, whatever, and just write that in there and run it everywhere. Now, if it doesn't work, I urge you to contact D&T. He'll be able to assist you further with that, for I have no idea what to do after that.
Yeah, I'll send you right along to somewhere else to see if you can find the answer, if this doesn't solve your problem.
We could send him to Black Kernel.
Yeah, I think that would be my first try.
Yeah, Black Kernel, he's an amazing developer. He writes code in Rust, so that obviously means he knows more than anybody else. And he did a show telling Ken that he was wrong in math and explained what was it about axioms and all that other stuff. Great show. Listen to it. And that's why you'll know you have to go to Black Kernel.
Yeah, I agree. Go to hackerpublicradio.org, go to the full episode guide, and just do Control F Black Kernel and check out some of those shows there. There's some good stuff. Another thing I know about him is that he really doesn't like those terminal file managers. He really hates them.
I'm some guy on the internet here with
D&T.
And we're out of here. Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. Goodbye.
Been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is.
hosting for HBR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.